From Public Radio International, I'm Madeline Brand, and this is America Abroad. Western policymakers want to promote democratic ideals in the Middle East and surrounding countries, but sometimes art can be more powerful than politics in fomenting change.
It's always going to be my duty to open my eyes and everybody else's eyes to things that happen in our society that don't seem right.
From theater to movies to rap, Islamic style.
In the region, especially in Lebanon, you have two choices. Either you hold an AK-47 and shoot people, or you use your art to express yourself, and that's hip-hop.
People are refusing to be silent, and they're insisting on being heard, and they're finding productive ways of being heard. And for me, that's something to be optimistic about, is that people have found their own voice and are demanding that people listen.
This hour, the power of art in a changing Middle East, next on America Abroad. But first, these headlines.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
From Public Radio International, I'm Madeline Brand, and this is America Abroad. This is the beat of change in the Middle East. The once hopeful political momentum of the Arab awakening in the Middle East and North Africa has given way to chaos and conflict. What has endured is art.
As an Islamic society, our parents have values and they believe that a girl should just stay home, get married. But I try to change these mentalities and just show that a girl can also do hip hop and do what she wants.
In places like the slums of Cairo, a new form of music has risen, combining a reggaeton beat over fiery lyrics, sometimes becoming the soundtrack for a new generation of dissent.
Millions and millions of young men and women listen to it, whether the tracks that are politically motivated or not.
From music to dance to film, art sometimes has a greater power to move millions, especially when politics fail.
I never imagined in my lifetime that people would actually break the fear barrier, and it's been broken. People are refusing to be silent, and they're insisting on being heard, and they're finding productive ways of being heard.
In the next hour, we will hear from some prominent artistic voices in the Middle East, in North Africa, and South Asia. We'll hear how their art incorporates their liberal ideals, their views on sectarian violence and on terrorism, and we'll hear how they're being received by audiences in the Arab and Muslim communities and in the West. First, we go to Egypt. For the last several years under President Mubarak, then the Muslim Brotherhood, and now the military regime of Abdullah Fattah al-Sisi, an expanding group of independent filmmakers has been trying to capture the gritty realities of life in the country, while carefully maneuvering around societal disapproval and government censorship. Kimberly Adams reports from Cairo.
This is what your typical Egyptian movie sounds like. Loud, boisterous, colorful, and more than a bit unrealistic of life in the country. And this is the sound of the slow-moving, often dimly lit film, Rags and Tatters, the most recent by Egyptian filmmaker Ahmed Abdallah. It uses hardly any dialogue to tell the story of a convict who escaped in the chaos after Egypt's 2011 revolution as he tries to slip back into society.
In my films, things are subtle.
According to Manal Omar, an associate vice president at the U.S. Institute for Peace, that strategy helps filmmakers tackle controversial topics governments may not want discussed.
Are they going to, have their messages that are more understated and subtle in the messaging, or are they going to go through, something that may be considered kind of a shock therapy that may be banned?
Another of Abdallah's films, Microphone, was released on the eve of Egypt's 2011 revolution and was one of the first independent films here to have a wide release in major theaters. The movie focused on underground musicians and artists in Egypt, and its gritty style is stark in its contrast to commercial productions.
Everything about it is different.
Joseph Fahim is an Egyptian movie critic and festival programmer. He says it's easy to tell between independent and commercial films here.
The narratives are different, the aesthetics are different, the production values are different, the acting is different. Everything is drastically different from mainstream cinema.
Filmmaker Abdallah says his low-key style also helps when it comes to Egypt's censors.
There is nothing they can really feel, they can get it in their hand and remove it. They know that probably they don't like the film, but there is nothing they can say about it because the film is very subtle.
Passing the censors here is a two-stage process, submitting the script for advance approval, then the finished movie for the final okay, although not all filmmakers do this. The Oscar-nominated film, The Square, wasn't widely shown here because of problems with censorship paperwork. Ahmed Awad, who recently resigned as head of Egypt's censorship authority, was in charge at the time. He says no one ever turned in the right documents and that he didn't block any films during his 6 months in office.
It doesn't mean that I will stop you to do your film. If you are saying a political opinion against the government, you can say it. But we have a problem with society censorship, not the governmental censorship.
That society censorship in conservative Egypt is indeed the main concern for filmmaker Maggie Morgan.
Nowadays, with the digital technology, you could practically make a film with any camera, and you don't really need a lot of money to make a film, but you do need the openness in people's minds, and you need the openness, in society.
Broad, almost fanatic support for President-elect Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has suppressed many opposition voices here and makes film critic Joseph Fahim worried about the space for freedom of expression.
The future of art in Egypt and not just filmmaking will depend on whether these filmmakers can have the audacity and the guts and the passion to change the system or not.
Morgan says she ran into problems with people on the street challenging her while shooting her latest film, Asham. In Asham, she follows several pairs of Egyptians as they pursue their hopes and dreams, from a bathroom attendant hoping for better work to a clown seeking to provide for his family. Morgan represents the rising prominence of women filmmakers who are having a big impact on the independent film scene.
It was interesting because in 1 year, in 2012, 2013, there were, if I remember correctly, Hela Lutfi's film, Coming Forth by Day, Ayten Amin's film.
She says though women filmmakers in Egypt have widely different styles, they do bring something in common.
I don't think any of the girls making films are sitting there and thinking, how do I make a film that expresses women? But I think that, the stories and the kind of anecdotes, the interest, the focus of these films is totally different than any other type of film.
There's something fresh, there's something new happening.
That's filmmaker Ahmed Abdallah again. He says in addition to the stronger presence of female filmmakers, more Egyptians in general are using cameras to turn a critical eye on society.
For me, that was one of the biggest achievements of the revolution. Now everyone has a camera and everyone knows that maybe it's the time to use his or her own camera.
And more people are watching as well. Maggie Morgan lobbied to have her critically acclaimed Asham shown in theaters here and succeeded.
5 years ago, I wouldn't have imagined a film like the one I made to be shown in the cinema and people going to see it.
But before the films can be widely screened, they still have to pass the censors and deal with conservative public opinion. Filmmaker Abdallah says dealing with such restrictions is just part of the job.
As filmmakers, we kept fighting during the Mubarak regime, and we kept fighting after Mubarak regime, and we will keep fighting. This is how it goes.
Maggie Morgan is also ready to deal with the censors, but it's the Egyptian people, weary of protests, conflict, and instability, that she's most worried about.
What for me is scary is me censoring myself. The other scary thing is the tyranny of public opinion. It's very difficult to stand up to that.
She says she constantly challenges herself to ensure her choices as an artist are based on what's authentic, not just what's acceptable. For America Abroad, I'm Kimberly Adams in Cairo.
As we've just heard, many of the filmmakers in Egypt are now commenting on events that transpired during the 2011 revolutions and their aftermath. But I asked Cynthia Schneider, a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University, who for many years has worked with artists across the region, whether artists can or should agitate for actual political change.
Artists are always agitating for change, and they do that through their works of art, you know, through their films, through their theater, if it's theater, through their visual arts, if it's visual arts, through literature. That's what they're constantly doing. I don't think it's really the position of artists actually to implement change. I think it is, in fact, their position to point out what needs to be changed, to crusade for that, and to show it to people in very clear and understandable terms, often in terms of narrative, that anybody can understand.
Is there some irony in that a lot of these dispossessed groups in the Middle East do not look that favorably upon the United States, and yet they embrace some of its culture?
Yes, you can see irony in that, but I think people outside the United States tend to be a little better than we are at separating the policy and the people. Actually, I don't think it's surprising at all, because what they admire in the artists is freedom of expression and the ability and right to criticize a government or authorities and not be punished for it, the assertion of the individual in society. That's what's admired in the art. And, you know, regrettably, at the moment, U.S. policy in the Middle East is not upholding those values. It is instead supporting the governments, you know, whether it's Mohamed Morsi in Egypt or the government since Morsi. We support governments that actually repress all the values that are expressed by our artists. So I don't think it's surprising at all.
Who are some of the most important voices in the Middle East and artists we should be paying attention to here?
There's quite a number of different ones. I think in music, there's this group Dam in Palestine. There's a great artist in Egypt, Deeb. There's a wonderful female Lebanese rapper named Malika. We are going to be hosting, actually, at Georgetown, a couple of extraordinary theatrical performances, and these are really surprising. The first, Syria, the Trojan Women, is a performance of the Trojan Women, which is staged by Syrian refugee women who initially were given the opportunity to perform theater in the refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon. And they did such a fantastic job that their work has been turned into a professional production. Another example from Pakistan, one of their leading theater companies, Ajoka Theater, which has been doing theater for social justice for 25 years in Pakistan. We're going to host them doing the performance of this is going to sound kind of strange, satire on U.S.-Pakistan relations. And the head of that company, Shahid Nadeem, has written a musical comedy about U.S.-Pakistan relations set in a U.S. consulate in Pakistan. And it does all these hilarious hoops that people have to jump through in order to get a visa to the United States.
Cynthia Schneider is a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University. Although Pakistan is not in the Middle East, like many of the Muslim-majority countries in the region, it has been affected by sectarian violence, religious extremism, and military rule. We called up Shahid Nadeem and talked to him about this production.
My latest play is called America Chalo, Destination USA, which we have been performing in Pakistan. It takes place in the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, the visa section. So that's the context of the story. And it's a hilarious play about the double standards from both sides and how people in Pakistan, they love to criticize USA, but at the same time, they would sell their souls to go and get residence in the US.
Nadeem has written more than 30 original and often political plays. He became the director of a Joka theater in the mid-1990s after years of living in exile.
My plays address the social issues like honor killing and this denial of education to girl students and religious tolerance or lack of it, and then dictatorship and corruption and good governance.
I asked him, how did his experience of being a political activist at the street level influence his art?
I was able to contribute to the change of one regime, but then I realized that the new regime was almost as bad as the first one. It was just a change of faces or slogans, but not much difference otherwise. And in that process, I realized that I am better at writing plays and trying to change the hearts and minds of people around me rather than change the whole world.
And have your plays, has your work attracted negative attention from the authorities?
Yes, I think one inspiration is through people who are motivated and who are inspired by your work. And another negative motivation is when people who do not want to let you carry on performing, and they hate your guts, hate your ideas, and want to create a society which is totally barren, then their hatred and their anger or their unease, that also inspires me. So I think that negative attention, for at least theater purposes, is good attention.
Hmm. Have you ever been threatened with arrest or anything like that for your work?
Yeah, well, I have been arrested a few times, partly for my writings and partly for my activism. Then some of our plays have been banned, and sometimes the government minister, they have announced that we are enemies of the state and enemies of Islam, and they are going to ban our theater group or banish us from Pakistan. So this has happened more frequently in the past, but these days, the major threat now comes from the invisible so-called non-state actors, the militant, violent extremists who want to create a society which is totally devoid of human rights and freedoms and open thinking. So they keep on threatening you through letters and through bombs and through phone calls, threatening phone calls. So I think that has now become a major issue. But coming to this question of negative attention, I can give you one example of my play called Burqa Vaganza, which is a play which uses burqa, the face veil, as a metaphor for double standards or for cover-ups. So some people regard burqa as an Islamic attire, as if it is a part of our faith for women to wear burqa, which is totally nonsense. It's just a cultural attire. But no one was talking about it, that this was being imposed on women by political extreme right-wing people. So when we produced this play, which exposed that myth, the play was banned a couple of times and we got threats, but it also then generated a lot of debate in the press, among the audience and on social media, that our purpose was still achieved even after the banning, although we defied the ban. But even after the banning and our inability to perform it widely, the debate was started, and that debate is still going on the social media and in various activist organizations. So sometimes negative publicity also helps you achieve your objective.
Do you think that you could be an artist and not take on political issues and not comment on the injustices you see in your culture?
In my own view, I would not be an artist. I would not be a playwright. I would not be a socially responsible human being if I was not reacting to injustice in society or to hypocrisy in society or violence in society or absence of peace and truth in society. So I think every artist or every writer does respond to the reality around them, especially if we are talking of playwrights or theater makers. Sometimes people don't accept it, or they want to pretend that they are totally neutral or they are totally disinterested in social or political issues and they are only interested in art. But I think they are lying to their audience as well as to themselves. So at least in theater, you cannot stay away from the reality around you because you are creating or recreating that reality on stage and you are interacting with your audience, live interaction with your audience. So it is impossible for you to pretend that these four walls of theater are such strong walls that they prevent any information from the outside world coming into your minds or in your theater hall.
Shahid Nadeem is director of the Ajoka Theater in Islamabad, Pakistan. And a note to listeners, Destination USA or Amrika Chalo will be performed at the Kennedy Center in January. You're listening to The Power of Art in a Changing Middle East on America Abroad. Coming up, a rap duo pushes for change in Lebanon.
Lebanon is always on international news because of the bombings, the war. And I want to show the positive side of the Lebanese scene.
Let us know your thoughts about this program. Tweet us at America_abroad.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Madeline Brand, and you're listening to The Power of Art in a Changing Middle East on America Abroad. The Arab uprisings in the Middle East and beyond allowed artists in countries like Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya to voice their opinions openly. In Lebanon, the same thing happened. After a grueling 15-year civil war that began in 1975, the country ended the war with an agreement that left both sides confused as to what was gained and what was lost. Tanya Saleh is a singer-songwriter who addresses this topic in her music. She's also stirred up a conversation in her country and elsewhere by singing about the long-standing pain and violence between the Sunnis and Shiites. She spoke to us about her journey as an artist.
My name is Tanya Saleh. I'm a singer-songwriter living in Lebanon. I'm also a visual artist. I have been in the music business for the past 15 to 16 years. In the Arab world, there's something very weird. Like, you see people singing about Habibi and my love and I love you and you left me and how beautiful you are, etc. And on the street and in the real life, you see them killing each other and making wars and trouble and, you know, so it doesn't make sense to me. So when I started writing my songs, I said to myself, if I'm not going to have anything to say, I might as well not say anything, you know. So I started writing. The first song was about the new generation. We were coming out of the war and we were just wondering where we're heading because the war has gone for like 15 years and then suddenly they stopped the war and we didn't understand why it started or how it ended. So it was very weird to me. So the first song I wrote was about that. Well, the first album had people confused about me. You know, they didn't know what to think about me. First, they thought, okay, she's doing something different. Let's appreciate that at least. And then they started, you know, as they heard the songs over and over again, of course, they were never broadcasted on any kind of TV or radio station in the beginning. I was on the internet and it started on the internet. And then the audience grew on the internet. And then when it became strong enough, people on TV started to want to talk to me, to introduce my songs to the general audience. And they thought that this was starting some kind of movement, but they didn't believe that it's going to grow in any way until maybe recently, when many other bands in the Arab world started to emerge and started to talk about their reality. And they found that what I was doing was just really mirroring the society the way it is.
So one of the songs that I've written for my second album was called Omar and Ali, which also represents the two names that are used to, in a Sunni family, you would name your son Omar because he represents one political and historical figure that you're proud of as a Sunni. And if you were a Shiite, you would call your son Ali, because it also represents another historical religious figure. So I wrote a song that I imagined two small boys playing, and just they had a fight, and then I was calling them to reconcile. And this song was very popular. I mean, it touched some kind of sensitive note in everyone's minds and hearts, and I guess it's because it's just portraying the real problem in our region. It's just becoming so unbearable, you know. So there's a lot of people like me who agree that we want peace and we want them to reconcile. My songs are not only there to please the Lebanese. All the Arab world is listening to them, and they seem to be able to connect with everybody because we all share the same problems. We all share the same culture almost, you know. We come from the same history. We connect. They always ask me, do you think that your songs are going to change anything? Do you think that the attitude is going to change? Well, it's not my duty to change. My duty is just to show to everyone that, yeah, we know that where the trouble is, and yeah, let's just talk about it and think about it and think of finding a way to solve it and be activists and try to say it out loud, you know. But I'm not a political person. I'm not into politics. I'm not a legal person. I don't know how to do it anyway. If I want to change the system, I don't have the tools. But I know that we need a civic society. I know that we need a secular society. We are a sectarian country with 18 sects, and that's impossible to deal with, you know? It's impossible to keep everybody happy.
That's Lebanese singer Tania Saleh. Saleh is currently working on her third studio album. It's called A Few Images, which she is funding through an online campaign. For a link to that and more music from Saleh, check out our website at americaabroad.org. And now some music from another part of the Middle East. That song is called Prince of Criminals, and it's by an Egyptian musician. His name is Shaban Abdel Rahim. He calls out the ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and the lyrics translate roughly into, "Oh, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, oh, Prince of the Criminals, it seems that you are a nut surrounded by crazy people." Prince of Criminals is one of many parodies that people in the Middle East have been making about ISIS. It's a topic that's been capturing the attention of Dean Obidallah. He's a comedian. He's based in New York, and he co-produces the Arab American Comedy Festival. He wrote about ISIS parodies for an article in the Daily Beast called The Middle East Goes Monty Python on ISIS. And he's here now. Dean Obidallah, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. So tell us, when did you start to notice that people were making fun of ISIS?
It was in the summer when we were hearing more stories about horrible beheadings. I was reading more articles from Middle Eastern papers written in English, my Arabic's too limited, talking about and documenting their mocking of ISIS in ways that I thought was remarkable to me and also very daring and courageous, frankly, because these are people living in not just the region, but in the countries where ISIS is operating, like Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, where they're right on the border there.
Well, tell us about some of the comedy. And does it translate to English-speaking audiences? Is it funny to us?
I think it's hard to say if it's really funny to the average comedy aficionado in the States here. But some of the things definitely I found humorous, at least. There was one by Palestinians, and these comedic actors dressed up like ISIS soldiers standing at a checkpoint, complete with the ISIS flag behind them and long beards, pretended to stop people at checkpoints, all the while mocking ISIS. Calling themselves ISISes, making fun of the hypocrisy when it comes to Islam, saying, oh, just last night we were in Beirut partying. So, you know, a lot of the comedy, when I found a common thread, is mocking the ISIS people as bumbling idiots on one hand, and secondly, and it's a big theme, is saying that ISIS does not represent Islam. You know, comedy can entertain and also make a bigger point, and they can inspire people to take action.
Well, tell us more about the risks that these comedians are taking, because does ISIS know, they must know who they are, and would they come after them?
I have no doubt if ISIS soldiers or militants could catch these people mocking them, they would kill them. And I say that not just hypothetically, I'm saying that based on something ISIS already said. Many Arabs use, instead of ISIS, they use the term Daesh, which is an acronym for what ISIS spells out. But Daesh also can mean a bigot who imposes his views on others, depending how it's said by Arabs. Now, ISIS heard about this, and publicly some ISIS officials said if they hear anyone referring to them as Daesh, they're going to cut their tongues out.
Who's watching these videos? Who's seeing these performances?
Well, a lot of it's on YouTube, so anyone who wants to access it through YouTube. Others is actually airing on, like, satellite television in Iraq, in Lebanon, on TV in Lebanon. There's a show called the Katil Selby Show that's airing there, and they did great sketches mocking ISIS. And often that could be very, very effective in making the average person who lives in the region laugh at ISIS. And that's the last thing I can tell you that ISIS wants. They don't want to be laughed at. They want to be feared.
We talked to another person who's observing these parodies. His name is Joe Khalil, and he's based in Qatar, and he's a professor at Northwestern University. And he looks at alternative media in the Arab world, and here's a clip of what he says about these parodies.
These types of parodies may not be able to get people on the streets to fight against ISIS and to attack them, but at least I think they would be able to demystify any type of appeal that such ideologies may have, just because people are able to laugh at them. And as a native speaker of Arabic, I tell you, these parodies are very, very funny.
You know, some people might laugh out loud. That would be great. But certainly the message coming across is that it's an amusing, entertaining look at cold-blooded killers like ISIS who want you to be afraid, and instead you're evoking laughter at their expense.
I'm wondering if they have affected you and your comedy. Have you changed your routine or thought about doing it differently after seeing these comics?
Not these comics per se. Going to perform in the Middle East has impacted my comedy in that when you go to the region and you do shows in the Middle East, the crowds there want you to do jokes about them. And now Americans probably are like, what do you mean? They want you to make fun of Islam? Not Islam per se, but they want you to make fun of Arab culture. And it's intertwined with Islam. You know, I do a joke about, you know, in the Arab world, they love to smoke cigarettes. I went to a gym in Jordan. There was an ashtray on the treadmill. So that's part of the culture of Arabs.
Well, Dean, thank you so much for coming on. That was really interesting.
Sure. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Dean Obidallah, New York-based comedian and co-producer of the Arab American Comedy Festival.
The problem is that people are afraid of us because they don't know really who we are. I mean, honestly, there are basically two news stories about us. And it's no one's fault, but there are. There's the bad story where we're described as militant gunmen and terrorists, and then the occasional positive one where we're described as alleged militant gunmen or terrorists.
Arabic hip-hop has grown in popularity in the past 20 years, although rappers and fans are still a small minority in the Arab-speaking world. One of them is a hip-hop duo called Ashaikman. Ben Gilbert has this report.
Ashaikman is a duo that embraces all aspects of hip-hop and, true to the tradition of the musical form, have added their own style, flair, and message. The group consists of a pair of twins, Omar and Mohammed Kabani, who were 18 years old when they started rapping and making graffiti art almost 14 years ago. They have built their music into a brand and clothing line and have gained notoriety notoriety for their social commentary and creative use of pop culture references in all the mediums they work in. In this song, called Ya Rate, meaning I wish or hopefully, Ashiq Man talk about the challenges facing most Lebanese as the country's cost of living skyrockets and making an honest living becomes more difficult by the day. The chorus basically says, I hope you're able to build a house, but it will run you into the ground. Omar Kabani says the group's name means exhaust pipe in Lebanese Arabic.
And it has a symbolic meaning, like all the dirt of the car comes out through the Ashiq Man. We do the same thing through our music or our art. So we try to expose the bad thing in society through our music, and that's Ashiq Man.
Omar says hip-hop is the perfect blend of politics, social commentary, and art, and that it's only natural that he and his brother use it to express themselves. Their father had a master's in political science, and their mother is a painter. As teenagers, they had plenty of material to write about. Lebanon was recovering from a 15-year civil war. So they began writing about the injustices and political issues they heard about, from the taxi driver who couldn't pay for his children's school to Lebanon's assassinations, bombings, and militias.
In the region, especially in Lebanon, like you have two choices. Either you need to blow some steam, so either you go hold an AK-47 and shoot people, or you need to use your art to express yourself. So you have two ways of expression, and of course we use the peaceful form of art, and that's hip-hop.
That's reflected in this track called Always Positive. The track is filled with references to Lebanese pop culture and history and commentary on the state of the country. At this point in the song, the duo talk about how expensive it is to live in Lebanon and the stratified nature of the country by playing on the old cliché that Lebanon is the Switzerland of the Middle East. They rap, "You need a visa to visit it, 2 hours to cross it, and 2 tires to block it." A reference to the burning tires often employed by rival political factions to shut down parts of the country. Omar says that, in addition to the sarcasm he uses to mock the country's leaders and political turmoil, that this track also shows his love for Beirut and Lebanon.
Lebanon is always on international news because of the bombings, the war, and I want to show the positive side of the Lebanese scene.
Ashiq Man are also known for their commitment to the Arabic language and Lebanese culture in their graffiti. They made a song about it, called The Walls Are Talking, about the political and social commentary on Beirut's walls. They are famous for their tags, which have mocked the country's bickering politicians in numerous political vacuums over the years by suggesting subtly that a Japanese anime character from the 1990s called Grandizer should be president of Lebanon.
We also did Bomberman. It's a video game, like this character like puts bombs and like run. So when there was 3-4 explosions here in Beirut, we did this and we wrote Matloub or Wanted. Like we want this Bomberman, we want this suicide bomber in a way. And also, like, we're being cynical but serious at the same time. You know?
The group only uses Arabic in its music, design, and graffiti, which is political in itself.
The new generation see us as more like we're doing the hip kind of Arabic, because Arabic now becoming more and more like it's not cool. People speak English or French most of the time in Beirut or in Lebanon, and we're trying to make the Arabic language cool again. So that's why Ashiq Man, in a way, was born. Especially the t-shirt and the graffiti, because we want to make the young generation proud of their heritage and proud of their culture.
Jackson Alliers is a journalist who watches Lebanon's hip-hop scene closely. He says Ashiq Man are the workhorses of Lebanon's hip-hop scene.
They are very, very hardworking musical brothers, very hardworking graffiti brothers that have seen the possibilities of growing their audience bases through their own friendships and peer networks, which is what they've done. And so they have a following in Lebanon that is very different, let's say, than other elements of the Lebanese rap community, because they've really, in a very do-it-yourself way, put themselves out there, you know, produced their own shows, been able to really get to certain elements of youth populations that relate to what they're doing. And they have more visibility because they are also a graffiti, graphics team that have had a lot of influence on the walls around Beirut with their signature graffiti pieces. So they're a unique combination within the community.
Alier says the group's lyrics are representative of Arabic hip-hop, generally, in that most rappers in the Arab world have very country-specific experiences, and thus lyrics, social and political commentary, even pop culture references, vary greatly. He says the Arab uprisings have allowed more hip-hoppers to speak their minds in the Arab world. The most obvious result in Lebanon, he says, is the appearance of Syrian rappers.
The Syrian rappers have always had the inability to speak their minds. Only really subsequently after the advent of the Syrian war in 2011 with the Syrian refugee influx, artistic refugee influx into Beirut and to Jordan, have you had a very active Syrian rap contingent coming up from the ranks, being able to say a lot more than they ever were able to say before.
As for Ashiq Man, they're expanding. They currently have a store where they sell their art and designs in Beirut, and they're hoping to expand to Dubai. For America Abroad, I'm Ben Gilbert in Beirut.
You're listening to The Power of Art in a Changing Middle East on America Abroad. Coming up, we head to the streets of Casablanca and a film that depicts the path from emotional and economic deprivation to terrorism.
We never thought that this could happen in Morocco, and especially that those suicide bombers would come from the inside.
To learn more and to see a trailer of the film, visit our website, americaabroad.org.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
I'm Madeline Brand, and you're listening to The Power of Art in a Changing Middle East on America Abroad. The Moroccan film Horses of God has recently been released in theaters across the U.S. It centers on one of the most tragic incidents in recent Moroccan history, the 2003 suicide terrorist bombings in Casablanca.
Overnight, a series of explosions tore through Casablanca. At least 40 people were killed, at least 60 injured. The targets of the simultaneous attacks include the Belgian consulate, a Jewish community center and Jewish cemetery.
Horses of God is a phrase used by the Prophet Muhammad in the Quran to describe those who fight for jihad. Originally, it was a phrase meant to spread the teachings of Islam, but today, radical groups use it to justify jihad against the West and the killing of innocent people. The film is directed by one of Morocco's most acclaimed directors, Nabil Ayouch, who grew up in Paris and now lives and works in Casablanca.
They felt totally abandoned by the rest of the society, mentally cut off, and lack of education for sure.
He told us the goal of his movie was to open people's eyes to the root causes of terrorism in young men. Before Nabil Ayouch began filming, he spent 2 years in Sidi Moumen, the sprawling slum on the outskirts of Casablanca, where the bombers grew up.
No father authority, no social care, no place for love, intimacy. So, yeah, I guess these young boys, when they see some radical religious leaders, and I don't even know if we should call them religious, because for me it's more mafia that is using religion, are coming and telling them that they're going to offer them a future and they're going to offer their kind of discipline, of course, they jump in and they want to make it and they want to prove themselves that they can make it.
It's really interesting because for most of the movie, in the first part of the movie, Yashin, the younger brother, is not religious at all. And when his older brother comes back from 2 years in prison and he has been converted to be very religious, he really looks at him skeptically and doesn't like who his older brother has become. But then he does fall under the sway of these religious leaders and you really see the transformation. And then at the end, he really becomes even more of a zealot than his older brother, Hamid. And let's play a little scene where you see him actually decide to become this new person. And this is a scene where you really see that. You really see where he has transformed from this secular, angry young man into a religious, angry young man. So they're on a suicide mission, and do they even understand that they're just pawns in this global conflict?
Oh, they do. They do. As a soldier that is sent by his general on the ground is understanding that. The thing is that they're brainwashed. And when you're brainwashed, you don't see things clearly anymore, even if you know what you're doing.
Who was the audience you had in mind when you made this film? Who did you want to see this film?
I think it's important for both Arab and Occidental audience to hear about this film and this point of view. For an Arab audience, because most of the time we don't want to face our reality as it is, and we should understand that if we do not do it, some others will come. And I'm talking of those Hollywood movies with their point of view, which I respect, but it's not my point of view as an Arab film director from the region. And for the Occidental audience, because, as I told you, from this type of movies, they're used to a very black and white speech about this important topic. You know, there is the bad guys and the good guys. And we have the tendency in those films to put out the names and the faces from the people who are the source of this violence, as if this violence comes from nowhere, as if it has no origin, you know. This violence doesn't come out from the sky.
What's been the reaction from the authorities in Morocco and just from people who've seen your film in Morocco? What do they say about it?
Well, I guess the film pleased some people and didn't please some others, but I had no official reaction of Moroccan authorities about the film. What I can tell you is that the Moroccan Cinematographic Center participated to the fundings, so they gave me a support, and I had no problem of censorship at all.
Although you don't paint the government in a particularly flattering light, or at least the state in a particularly flattering light, the police are corrupt. There's nothing offered to these poor young boys in terms of a future.
Yes, but I guess it's our part of the job as film directors to show this reality. And I think the authorities are smart enough to understand it. This is, of course, the state responsibility, but this is also the citizens' responsibility, the civil society responsibility. I mean, we are all in the same boat. So if we want another future for those boys, we have to offer them something else. And that's what I'm fighting for, actually, with Mahi Binbin, the author of the novel. We decided since 1 year to open a cultural center in the center of the slum in Sidi Moumen, for those young people to have some other ways of expression, like arts, culture especially. And the center, after fundraising that we done last year, opened a month ago.
And I understand that you screened the movie and families of the bombers and families of the victims saw it together.
Exactly.
And what was their reaction being brought together and watching the movie together?
Well, actually, it was the very first time, as you can imagine, that the families of the victims who came from the center of Casablanca and some families of the suicide bombers met each other. So there was a lot of tension in the beginning and emotions when they talked to each other, when they recognized each other. Some, at a certain point, said, sorry, I apologize. I think that they met. I think that some people who lost a father, brother, sister came to the slum to meet them. And it's a huge step, I guess, for our society. And it means a lot. It means that mixity between rich and poor is one of the key between men and women, the minorities. I mean, the biggest danger for our society is to have those walls that you cannot see, but you can feel between different categories of the population. So when some people decide to come and to meet and to spend some time and to listen to other people that they never cross the rest of the day, I guess it's very important. It says a lot.
Now, also from Morocco, we meet this young woman, Hijar Chaiboub, a.k.a. B-Girl Scarf. She's one of the first women to have broken the social barriers for female hijab-wearing hip-hop artists in the Middle East. Producer Jake Warga brings us this postcard from Rabat.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Hajar. Kaitulia B-Girl Scarf.
My name is Hajar. They call me B-Girl Scarf. I am 19 years old and this is my last year of high school.
Hijab, تقول لي أول break dance hijab.
Some people come to me and are like, hey, you're wearing hijab, so why are you doing hip-hop? I believe that there is no rule or rule set saying that you cannot do hip-hop if you're wearing hijab. When I first started, I was kind of the only one in the Arab world that is doing a hip-hop as a girl wearing hijab. But then I started sending links on YouTube as tutorials of dancing, teaching different girls wearing hijab hip-hop as well, and just encouraging everyone to dance, even girls. In the Moroccan society, it's just parents sometimes don't let their girls that wear hijab like do hip-hop. As an Islamic society, our parents have values and they believe that a girl should just stay home, get married. But I try to change these mentalities and just show that a girl can also do hip-hop and do what she wants. I started first with my mother trying to convince her that this is what I want to do. And now the only constraints I'm facing is basically my uncles, kind of narrow-minded. Some of them know that I do hip-hop, but never like saw me dancing it. And others don't know. And actually, I prefer it like this, because if they did know, I don't know what will happen to me.
B-girl, my B-boy. يعني كنت نفسه ما بديتهم هنا في المغرب نو حيت احنا بلد
اسلامي. Overseas and abroad, you can have a B-girl facing a B-boy, which is a girl against a boy doing a battle. But in the Moroccan society or in the Arab world, you still find like a girl will just face or battle another girl. There are still some, let's say, cultural constraints that just bring girls to compete with girls and boys to compete with boys.
وخا البريك دانس والهيب هوب كنقدروا نديروا قناوه ولا المهم شي رقص اللي هو مغربي لا علاقه له بداك الهيب هوب ديال
I've won a prize on the best show once when I danced hip hop and break dance on a gnawa song and the jury came to me and were like that was really original like no one danced on gnawa The basics we got them from the US but we will dance on gnawa or any Moroccan music just to make it our own
ان شاء الله اذا كانت عندي بنت في المستقبل
I just want to say to all the girls that have a passion and hobbies just to pursue it and to not think or even take into consideration what other people say because if they think they're good at what they're doing they will just excel in it and be good at it I am actually against and competing against all the people that say or believe that a girl should just stay home sometimes not even study I just believe that a girl should fight for her dreams and make them come true.
That came to us from producer Jake Warga from Rabat, Morocco. To see clips of B-Girl's scarf breakdancing, go to our website, americaabroad.org. This hour was written and edited by Martha Little and produced by Rob Sachs, with additional production help from Flan Williams. Audio engineering support was provided by Mario Saavedra at KCRW. Our interns are Rebecca Rossman and Michael Abrams. You can hear past programs by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, finding us on the TuneIn or Public Radio International apps, or by visiting our website, americaabroad.org. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is America Abroad from Public Radio International. Support for this show was provided by Public Radio International stations and listeners like you. Support was also provided by the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, the Luce Foundation, and Turkish Airlines.
PRI, Public Radio International.